Well, and we developed this system at a time when we weren't having those conversations platforms, you know? And so it's which is also why he's like, well, why don't you sell that? It's like, well, because would we be selling a benefit to people or just another problem? Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 318 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm a human-man.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is July 1th, 2021. Dunk on everyone.
Before we get started. Welcome to the second half of the whole year.
Yeah. Second half. Before we get any further, there's going to be swears on this show. And also, we'd like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thanks for letting us grab your money.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Favreau.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do it.
We left off last episode.
We were being coy, and then we were like, wait, why are we being coy? And then we kind of gave some details, but we didn't have all the details yet because we had just started. But we should probably recap what the situation was for those who didn't listen.
We were getting hit by lots of bugs in our former sort of work management software called ClickUp. It was undoing a bunch of stuff, and it was getting real annoying. So Sam did a bunch of digging and found this just wacky thing called Favreau that we, over the past week, have migrated our entire studio's operations and workflows into. And it good.
It's very good. Yes.
Let's talk about
it. Yeah, so for those who aren't aware of what Favreau is, as I certainly wasn't, it's a project management tool that's actually – it was built by a game dev team originally because presumably they were as frustrated with trying to manage work as basically we have been in a game context where basically everything has so many different collaborative inputs to finish one piece of work that goes into a project, and managing all those things all at once through what I would call confetti cards, which is you have one thing you need to get done. Like, let's put this torch in the game. And in order to do that, then you explode it into like 50 different separate cards that then you
hand those off to 50 different people.
Mm-hmm. And now you just don't even know what the hell is happening. Unless you do all sorts of other like weird dependency tracking stuff, which is what we used to try to do, but never quite worked. So
also, I think most people are using, you know, Jira for just like everything. I don't know. Does Jira somehow – I mean, I know literally everybody who uses it hates it, but does it somehow address this problem that you're describing also in its own way?
No. Okay. Jira is an evolved bug tracking tool that people just use for project management because they've been using it internally for like, you know, decades. They probably
It's like the Windows XP of work management.
Honestly, right? Yes. But importantly,
people use it because they've been using it.
If you are a person who uses Jira or who is forced to, actually it's sort of actually mostly the case with people who work with Jira in their day-to-day lives, then Favreau has direct integration and complete syncing with Jira issues. In other words, just manage your shit with Favreau and let it do the updates on the Jira side for you, and then just don't tell anybody. You know what I mean?
Don't tell anybody.
No one needs to know.
Don't even tell anybody.
But anyway, so we switched over to this thing largely to solve these ClickUp woes we were having. And as we talked about in last podcast, whenever you switch to a new tool, the new capabilities of that tool reshape your ability to conceptualize what work is, how to get it done, how even to split it up to different people, etc. And so this one with Favreau being one of the weirdest ones because of the nature of tasks in Favreau, which is that a single task can live in multiple places at the same time, which simply means that, say, we have that torch example again. If I'm like, okay, we're going to work on this torch this week, that torch can then go into my workflow and Seth's workflow separately, even though it's the same thing. We can see that happening. We can set up all sorts of automations to trigger certain things for other people once it hits certain points in our workflows. And
well, this also means stuff like at no point do I need to say to Sam like, "Hey, what's going on with this torch?" Because it like if I look at the card in the my board, then I can see there's a little marker and then that'll say, "This is in Sam's board. It's currently in his today pile." Right. So I know exactly where it is in his workflow. And anything that I do, like if I had a little like implementation checklist to that card for myself to help me sort of like go through it, he can see that And if he puts a, if he's working up a concept and he throws that on the card, I can see it because it's the same card.
Well, so every board has its own workflows. Yeah, every board has its own status, which is, you know, a classic way of labeling things as progressing through some system, right? So every board has its own status field, and then also other arbitrary fields that you can add. And when every time a card hits a new board, it basically just also gets those fields added to it. Mm-hmm. And so as long as everything is well named and organized and all of that, then you can be, and I found myself doing this yesterday evening. Actually, I had to fix a bug, and in the process, there was another thing on my list that I was supposed to do later this week. And I was like, oh, I'll just do this while I'm thinking about it, right? But I didn't know how the bug tracker was set up Southern Jordan had put together. Yeah. But I knew it was in there because that's how it ended up coming to me, right? And so I was like, oh shit, now I have to figure out how to mark it as being done there, you know? But then I was like, wait a second, I just opened the card when I finished it. And it was in my sprint, you know, for the week. And so I just like marked it
but
as
also
done
in
for
the bug
me.
Tracker.
Yeah. And then I looked at, and then I found the bug tracker status field and then clicked it open to see what the options were. And one of them was complete or whatever. And I was like,
resolved.
Oh, resolved. Yeah. So I was like, okay, well, I resolved it. So I just hit that. And then whatever had to happen for that to be okay, then it just happened.
Because we set a bunch of automations on our new issue tracking board. We're like, yeah, when you resolve something, it gets removed from the active issues board, boom, kicked over to the archives. It's still there, actually. And even there, a member of the QA team can go find it and they can reopen it, which then sort of like marks it as incomplete, pops it back into the active board and alerts the other testers like, hey, we got to get some more information on this thing, right? It's all automatic.
Yeah, so I got to say, the big wins here that we end up being able to see on the management side, why anybody might be interested in this, if you haven't quite gotten it yet, is that a lot of your work, a shocking amount of your work, actually.
Maybe even most of it.
Yes, is actually just handing stuff around, moving stuff around to the appropriate people, letting people know about certain things happening. And then essentially tracking changes or tracking the status of various works in progress, right? And this is literally the job of a producer at a game studio is supposed to be the person who is basically somehow aware of the status of various pieces of work and is keeping track of the timelines and the budget for a project and trying to keep things kind of up to speed. And what's really interesting with a tool like this is that it seems like it allows you to more or less have it be the case that production role, some component of that production role, that glue that sort of like lets everybody know that things are happening and where they are and alerting people is just like actually taken care of by the tool and by the people who are doing the individual pieces of work, as opposed to like having to now also relay that information back up to another entity.
Well, actually, you can also think of it as for a small team, it basically means that you can be bigger before you need to have a person's job be to like keep track of the work, right? And for a bigger team, it means that now the producer style role, which is also about, you know, making sure all the different teams that become more and more siloed as you scale up, right? That because even if the stuff is visible and you have really good systems for everything, there begins to be so much information, mm-hmm. right? Because part of the rule of all of this stuff is to make work visible, to make stuff visible, right? But there's a subtitle there, which is when it matters, right?
Yes.
That's actually the important bit, because if work is just visible, then it's all noise and chaos because that's all
if
the things
all
that
work
could happen.
Is visible all the time.
Yeah. That's nothing. And so the right work needs to be available at the right time. And so you need some combination of planning and automations, and then all collectively in the same tool that supports that to make it really easy so that you can see the stuff that you need to see when you need to see it. And depending on your role, that's different stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can start seeing like the producer role moves upstream a little bit more, right? And you can manage more stuff because it's easier to see all of it. And so now your job becomes to which is what it always is. It's just that now you take out the component of trying to figure out what's going on. You can just see what's going on.
It's a component of moving information around, which is not as useful as being able to actually make decisions about what should be happening, right?
Yeah.
Right. Right. So you're saying as a producer in a system like this, your job would now become figuring out ways to make the work move around more easily on its own, as opposed to you being the one who is moving work between organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then basically keeping track of like milestones and making sure everybody knows what – it's basically now it's putting that – it's like doing – making sure that the work is being organized and being monitored not just for what work is being done – but how long it's taking.
What, you know what this is? Right? This is the crash, the original Crashlands infinite inventory system.
Yes.
You know, because we were like, if your inventory is infinite, then you can just pick up everything, right? Mm-hmm. Which is great, because having to decide what to not pick up in crafting games and stuff was always just, yeah. I hated it, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I want all of it. Give me all of it. I'm an American. Give me all of the things, right? So we did that, but then we had, I don't know if you remember this, Sam, we had, like, we started with a finite inventory and we just kept adding chests. Like, we had a chests.
Yeah. You terraria
it. It's just like we just kept adding slots and adding slots. And eventually we were like, I hate this. Cause now you're spending so much of your gameplay just trying to figure out where to put shit, just moving shit around. And then eventually we say, okay, you know what? It's inventory. It's infinite. There's no chests.
You didn't even get to see it.
Now what? Yeah. Well, that was the answer. Like, how do you do that? Well, you need to think about inventory differently, right? Which is where are your helms? Well, who gives a shit, right? Like, you only care about what helms you have if you're considering equipping one. Mm-hmm. So click on the head slot where you would be equipping it, and boom, you can see the helms, right? So it's like – it serves up the information only when you need it, right, and then otherwise it just gets out of your face.
Yeah, there could be intermediate ways to do that too, right? Where there's like – there's a chest that is the helms chest or whatever, right? That's what its purpose. That's what it was made for in the game. There's only one of it. You don't have to worry about a jillion chests, any one of which might have, you know, helms and so on. I mean, this is always the part of these kinds of games where once I start getting into that phase where it becomes a drag, you know, because my wife and I played
a lot of Valheim. That's when you start a new save.
My wife and I played a lot of Valheim, and we got to the point where now the tier that we're in just requires, like, it's just, you know, it's just fetch quest after fetch quest, but not in the sense of like somebody's telling us to get something, but it's just like, oh, we need a whole bunch more of this ore, right? So we go run up a mountain and then harvest ore until we're full up on weight. Then we run back down, and in the same process, we've collected a bunch of random stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And now we have, like, I think 20 chests, I think, like in our house, you know. So then we come back in, and we're like, okay, where? And then we try to remember
which is the ore chest.
Yep. And then we're like, oh wait, do we have enough food? And we're like, which one's the food chest? Like, do we need to start like fermenting some things? Where's the fermentables go? Right? It's like it just becomes this really just mentally taxing.
It becomes a management game.
Yeah. So
difficult. And so this is actually a really interesting thing about DevOps, which seemed kind of like a revelation, but it's like kind of obvious in retrospect, which is, you know, they always talked about whether you're doing software development or anything, if you think about each unit of work in the same way that a factory does, right? And that, what do they call it? Work in process is the silent killer, right? Mm-hmm. It's like having a huge backlog of stuff piled up somewhere, like raw materials that you just haven't processed and done anything with, is hugely expensive because you have to store it and track it and maintain it and make sure it's fine and purge it if it, you know, goes bad, which in the mm-hmm. case of like tech work is like going through the list of 1,000 things from a project and archiving the stuff that's no longer relevant, right? Mm-hmm. So like you want as little stuff in the pipeline as possible and only the stuff that you need, and you only want to see the stuff that is relevant in the exact moment, right? And so it seems like I think no system will actually do that, like 100%. You know what I mean? Because that's an ideal.
Yeah, right? there's a scaling problem with that too, right? Because there's always a point where a person needs to intervene to basically triage, right? To say like I'm capable of evaluating this thing in the context of what is important against some sort of metrics, right? To decide what's supposed to happen. At some point, a person has to do that when you're ingesting new things, right? And so there's just always a scale problem here. And as things, as a team gets bigger, managing more kinds of things, as they become more isolated, and as the number of inputs increases, then it's – yeah, yeah. Because it's already really hard, like for us with 6 people, you know? Really fucking hard.
Only have 6 people.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting because we talk about this a lot too. Trying to figure out, because most software and most like workflow philosophies are designed around large teams, or actually large entities, like large projects that have multiple teams where the teams are largely siloed and manage some sort of portion of it, right? And so, and there's somebody above that team who has broader context so that they're able to figure out what the team should be doing so the team doesn't have to know.
So right? Kind of allocate sections of work.
Yeah. And this is why things get hierarchical, right? Because the idea is that as things just get bigger, there's just not a person who could possibly – and people at the lowest level just can't keep track of all of the shit and how their stuff fits into the context, right?
They got to move their part forward, but that's a full-time job. Yeah. So they can't see everything else.
Yeah. Exactly. So kind of everything is built for this. And something that we always find ourselves wondering is, and our case is very different, not just because we're smaller, but also because there's no isolation, right? So, or not nearly as much. So we all on the whole team have to kind of know what everybody's up to because we all needed to collaborate with each other on various aspects because we're all doing lots of things. And which is a completely different model. And it's one of the things I don't really know how to think about is like, it definitely requires different workflows, but also in my mind, as you scale, everything becomes harder and more complicated. But I wonder, is it not actually relatively more complicated because things begin to have to be isolated more in order to scale. And once you've done that, it gets easier to manage within those contexts. Yeah. Right.
I imagine that's how it goes. I think it's the same level of hardness, just with a different set of
just
problems.
Different problems, yeah.
Yeah, different places where the difficulty shows up.
And it also helps to explain to you that there's that whole thing about when a business first starts to scale, it almost always turns into a collapse, right?
Yeah.
Because that conversion, if you don't take into account that none of the workflows can be the same, right? Especially when they weren't likely designed that well in the first place.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there's a, what do they call it? It's like, there's like a death valley of entrepreneurship, which is,
it's called crossing the chasm.
There's like a phase where, which is actually like we are still in sort of like a founder / startup mode, which is that the owners of the company are also doing a lot of the work of the company, right? Like we do the business management, but also we're the production team. And so for us to, let's say, like add three people, isn't just an informational problem. It's also a huge like organizational like allocation of work problem, mm-hmm. right? Because if the three of us like insisted on continuing to be both the production team and the management team, then now we're sort of like having to be in the loop on even more things while also doing the work on even more projects because more projects are happening now because we got three more people, right? And so there's like this gap. Mm-hmm. I think once you have maybe like 100 people, and like sure, adding one more person is like, okay, sure, slot them in, right? Mm-hmm. So
you didn't even know it's happening. If you're now like running that company, there's a manager, you know, three levels of hierarchy below you.
Yeah, it could happen in a different team department.
Of six like, people who
somebody new just appeared last week. I didn't even notice.
Right, and that's why like there's always a huge difference in how companies run. But one of the models, there's like two key models, like the really big ones are. There's an HR department who's responsible for all of hiring and staffing and firing and everything, right? And so if you as a manager need a person, you go to them and they decide, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other one is that it happens at the management level so that if you're managing a team, then you get to decide if you need more people, need fewer people, and you do the hiring also, right? It's this interesting difference between like do you decentralize or do you centralize even harder, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you try to scale and do things, and it's
and both are disruptive because they're both different than what you've been doing, and it can be tough.
Well, honestly, I think we think about it just like when we talk about building a video game, which is every time you add one additional thing into your game, the context for the whole rest of the game that you built before that is now different, and so if you mm-hmm. don't update basically everything because of the new thing. Or at least allow
you
yourself
to keep, if you just keep adding new things,
which is also true for life.
Right? Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. You start working from home and then you don't sit down with your family members and say, wait a second.
What the hell does this mean?
Yeah. What does this mean now? Like I'm home all day and I didn't used to be before, but I am still obligated to spend most of that time doing this work. And also I need a space to do it. Right. And so what is that?
What is it? Everything's different now.
Everything's different now.
Yeah, in our game dev sort of parlance, people talk about the idea of a vertical slice, which is you've got all the systems in the game, and now you've got like some content and all, so you can kind of see how the whole game is, right? We in our studio, we try to think of things more as a diagonal slice, which is like we add systems, and then we add enough content to understand that system, right? Then when we add the next system, we need to go back. Yep. Got to go back, right? So you kind of like you don't just add all the systems in one go.
It's a swirly diagonal, right? It's like as you go up, it kind of like it keeps doing like pigtail loops, you know, as it's going up and to the right.
But of course, a company is the same way, which is like a company is a big stack of systems and content. Content meaning like the work and the people that's moving through the systems, right? And so, yeah, if you add any people, it changes. And if you add any systems, it changes. And you got to revisit the whole thing to restabilize the context before you change it again.
Yeah. Which is all to say, basically, that we've, you know, as we talked about last week too, we've tried a jillion ways to manage work. And we've tried scaling in various ways. Never like going big because one, we don't want to, but also we can't afford it. and trying to figure out how to do that. And what we've always found was that the tools that we picked, we picked them based on how we thought we were either how we were already doing work or how we thought we needed to, right? And the goal was to make sure that that thing could do that, whatever that was. Mm-hmm. And the problem was is that if it didn't then have the flexibility to dramatically adapt to a change of circumstance or us realizing that actually this wasn't a good way to do stuff, right? Then all of a sudden we just like kind of were stuck. And we also couldn't try new things because the tool didn't support it, right? And so we kind of find ourselves moving into more expanded capability tools as they were coming out and becoming more production ready, because this is also a fairly new phenomenon of these things existing. And so that's what we've been doing. And it kind of feels like we hit some sort of a local maximum finally with Favro, because it's just so fucking flexible.
Yeah.
What will remain to be seen is just we're gonna bump into weird constraints with it and stuff. And we already have a bit because no tool does everything, and no tool does everything the way exactly that you want it to.
And they haven't invested heavily enough in kinds of automations.
So it remains to be seen if they continue to expand the feature set to make this tool more and more capable over time in a way that doesn't break it. I think we would stick with it for quite a while. But it's also the case that as people, we are a gas. We expand to fill the space that we're in. At a certain point, we will have a new set of problems that Favro maybe can't help us with. Mm-hmm. And then we will find a new tool, right? So that's just the cycle, you know? So, yep. Sam, are you going to say something?
Well, I think, we talk about the idea of growth, growing a company, scaling a company, et cetera. And I think it's always made me uncomfortable trying to figure out how to think about it within like my own domain of work. Because while it's certainly the case that I would love to have some more bandwidth, because as we've talked about in the podcast a bunch, when you're a team this small, everyone's doing multiple things. And there's a tendency for at least like half your team to basically be bottlenecking various aspects of studio management and studio process. So while it's the case that I would definitely love to have more bandwidth to be able to do certain things, there's the interesting point and the interesting trade-off, which is that in order to get that bandwidth
you have to have
less stuff to do. And so the challenge is basically when you're also the one managing, then adding a person. So say
we add another thing you have to manage.
Yes. And so basically you have to actually hit a point with your management capability and your tools capability where, and then of course also the person you choose to hire being just really, really good from the get-go, that bringing that person on, while it absorbs management energy and does create that kind of work for you, actually does produce slack for you. And I think honestly, working in Favro for the last week now, as we're going to kind of transition over to it, has been the first time because of the multi-card thing that I've been like, oh, I could see how maybe that might actually be possible now, as opposed to just always feeling like, if we just add another person, then I would just be doing that too on top of this other stuff. Yeah.
Well, if you think about how much of your time has to go into either asking people what's going on with stuff or telling people what's going on with stuff.
Yes.
Right. Like, yep. or
training.
Training, piecing together a big thing to like a big document, so that you can hand off a piece of work to somebody, as opposed to them just already having a pretty good context of it already because they're working in a system that gives them all the information they need, and then the handoff becomes easier and faster. I think actually the most interesting thing was that we have been trying to find ways to sort of update our QA testing process over the past like couple of months. Actually, we've been like talking through it. Because back when we first designed our QA, like our internal QA reporting system, we didn't know what to expect. We'd never had internal QA. And so we were like,
oh, we also didn't design an internal one. We designed an external one first.
Yes. We designed it thinking we're going to release Levelhead and we need to intake just a lot of stuff from players. And we don't really know what the quality level of that's going to be. It's going to be, well, we know it's variable. It's highly variable. Yeah. And so we used that same system for our internal QA team. So they used basically like that same sort of feedback thing that our players used, which kind of created sort of like a one directional channel where like our internal QA team would send us stuff. And if we had more questions about that issue, then the questions would go right back to that original tester who reported it. But it was like an isolated channel. So that conversation sort of was locked in between those two people, and there wasn't a lot of collaboration or visibility for the rest of the QA team about that incident, about that bug or whatever. So that leads to like creating a lot of duplicate reports potentially, or even just like testers not being able to easily collaborate with each other to replicate issues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we'd come up with all kinds of different mechanisms, even looking at like, can we use GitHub issues? Can we migrate the feedback into there?
We designed a whole, like I spent basically a week designing and another week implementing a whole process of managing QA tickets and workflows with automations in GitHub, which for those listening who are familiar with that platform. But like we did all of that. That was just like, and we finished that last week, right? Like we were
right before we switched to Fiverr. We were about to onboard the QA team and then say onto that new system, which actually like it was basically trying to make GitHub do these things that it really wasn't intended to do in terms of like having lots of these like automated workflows for handling issues in ways that were particular to us. But then when we found Fiverr, then we looked at what we were doing in GitHub and we were like, we could just do this at Fiverr, but way easier and way faster. And way more, and the onboarding would be almost free, right? So we like,
and changing, and really importantly, making changes to that workflow.
Yes,
is now trivial is the wrong word because it gets
almost anybody can do it now.
But almost anybody can do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so we put together just a little dashboard, and it's like, okay, QA team, this is your dashboard. You just come here. Literally everything you need is here. All the information you need. If you need to report bugs, you do it here. If you need to reopen tickets, you can do that. You can also see the status of your tickets because it's in Fiverr. So your tickets exist both in the issue tracker and in our workflows, right?
Yeah,
so
it's the so same you can ticket
see,
now. Yep.
You can see what's happening. You can collaborate with each other. It's like it just suddenly solved all of our problems. And it took like 6 hours to sort of like think through how to set it up, get all the automations going. And then boom, we were able to just
We should say with this talk about how cool Fiverr is and how we can do all kinds of stuff with it. All that is true, but the overhead cost of figuring out how you want those workflows to look.
You still have to decide a lot of things.
We have spent a lot of time.
That's why it's been a week. That transition, like, yeah, so, oh, yeah, it took like 6 hours to figure that whole thing out, right? Except like we had to do that 6 hours for everything that we do in the studios, like think through how we want every single thing, every workflow to be to get that.
After things have settled a bit, once like we feel like we're not iterating as aggressively anymore in a couple weeks or so. It would be fun to put together just some videos, you know, of like, here's how we set up all of our miscellaneous workflows, you know, in this tool. Because it's
pretty cool.
Because it's hard to explain what these things are. And I think one of the interesting things too is you know, Seth noted that the onboarding is easier because everything is there and so much stuff can be automated. And then you find this interesting challenge with that, which is they're complex, the workflows that have been put together, right? And so when you first come into it, either trying to design a workflow or within the workflow that's there, trying to like – if you're trying to explain to somebody, you know, like, okay, so first like a card starts here. Like this is where you look. And then once this gets added to it, it pops over here. And now this person can see it and, you know, whatever. Like it actually is – it starts to feel overwhelming very quickly when you're trying to understand how everything moves, right? But if you focus on the part that matters, which is where – Like this is after it's already been designed, because that's very hard. But once you focus on the part that matters, which is where is information surfaced to me that I need to deal with?
Yes.
Right? And how do I get the right information to other people? And if those things are kept very, very, very simple, so that all the complexity is behind the scenes,
via
mechanisms allowing that to happen,
yeah,
then orienting somebody to what is actually very a very complicated thing becomes much easier. And even with the orientation part, if you're trying to explain too much about how it works to kind of take the magic away and like try to get a sense of what's going on here, even if a person's getting overwhelmed, once they start using it, if you've done your designs well, it'll be intuitive and it'll just work.
Well, it's like you were talking about with the issue tracker. So we set up the QA system with tons of automations, right? So that Adam got a ticket sent to him with no explanation of how the ticketing system worked.
Okay? Yeah, it was just in my inbox.
I did that on purpose because I was like, I want to see how obvious this is, right? So went to his inbox and then he took care of it. And then he just saw that there was a little drop down on the card that was like issue status. And he was like, oh, and he flipped that to resolved and boom, all the automations take care of everything after that.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't have to do anything else. Just set it to resolved and move on.
Yeah. And that same card that's representing that bug actually basically became a card now representing a fix, right? And it has the history on it of anything people talked about related to it. Has all the info from all the boards it's been on as work was done, right? And then also it's still in my system, just independently, because now I have my own process by which I move individual work items that I'm taking care of. That's just the way that I want to do it. And so right now there's basically just a review call that's sitting there waiting. And that card is sitting in there too, waiting until today, because every day I basically go through and say like, okay, what got done yesterday? And then I can archive it or delete it.
But it's up to you.
Still in the bug tracker. So it's
still in the bug tracker. Yep. Yeah. So I think this like it lets things be super centralized and long lived with tons of history accumulating on specific cards. They can be handed off between departments with like no cost and no explanation. Right. Like if you set up the workflows well, it's just like, this is yours now. Somebody can just look at it and be like, oh, I get this.
Yeah. Right?
And then you move like, so what's been really, I think, interesting about all of this is that like along with the Favreau transition, like I have this new dog, right? It's been an incredibly chaotic week for me. But I've still actually gotten the same amount of stuff done for development in Crashlands 2 as I did in this basically the same time period the week prior when I didn't have all this administrative work to do when I was working in ClickUp. because when I do decide like, okay, it's time for me to do development. It's time for me to work on Crashlands 2. We've set up our systems now in Favreau so that I exactly know what's next and I don't need to go to Sam and be like, hey, does this make sense for me to work on next? Because we have a roadmap, right? And like, I just bring it in, work on stuff, boom, boom, boom. Like, it's all just, I know what needs to happen now and I don't have to stress about it.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's just been, oh man.
I'm very excited to see what the next couple of weeks looks like.
It's blowing my mind.
On the end of these, all these workflow transitions. So
it's, anyways, I know this sounds like a sponsored podcast. You know, Favreau, like, go ahead and just, money grabbed up, be sketched out.
Yeah, just spend there for us. Huh?
Go ahead. We'll grab your money. We'll be fine with that.
Definitely.
But no, it's not sponsored. We're just really pumped about this thing. And it's Favro, Favreau. For some reason, I feel like it's a French word and it should be like,
I think they're Swedish or something.
They're based in Stockholm.
European or Stockholm.
Yeah. I don't know. But I will say, if you want to learn about Favreau, drink a lot of coffee because their YouTube videos explaining how it works are boring as fuck. Like, they're like 30 minutes long with a dude just talking through.
I actually enjoyed the video a lot, to be honest with you.
Also, they're more recent ones. Also, yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
But like their more recent videos are better, but they have some from I think like a year ago when they were kind of first getting things going. And it's like echoey ass room, like a guy way too far from the mic, like an hour long PowerPoint, and they're talking about like their like number of clients across the world and KPIs. And I'm like, don't. just show me the thing. So anyways.
Yeah, go get it, people. Go get it.
But yeah, this is just like a message out to Favreau. Like, make a video that's more exciting because your product's fucking amazing and you got to kind of like hype it up a bit more. Anyways,
yeah.
Let's get on to some questions.
Yeah, I was just gonna say the last kind of piece of this puzzle, besides organizing all this work, is then integrating it to all of our other systems to get it fully centralized. So that's kind
totally
of the
forgot
last,
about that.
Yeah, that's the last piece of all of this. But I was just thinking about this yesterday because I popped open our website to do something, you know, and I was like, oh shit, right, the alerts, because we have alerts that are in our website for support tickets and stuff that get assigned to us. But that's currently just where they are. And that's variously been integrated with things at various points, but we keep on changing things, changing how we want to work on stuff. And so like, that's just kind of, they've just been sitting there now for some time. And, but it's decentralized. It's somewhere else. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the whole fucking team, unless that's part of their normal day, like, so for Jordan, who is always ingesting all the player
feedback
tickets, right? He's there every day. So like, his stuff gets covered, right? But the rest of us, less so, because we just forget that stuff is over there, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, so yesterday I went in and found a 7-day-old ticket, which is, you know, not ideal, but it was even worse than that because it represented a problem, like a really bad problem that made login impossible for people who were trying to log in using legacy, like legacy Crashlands still uses B-Sketch ID. It made it not only impossible, but in the most like confusing, baffling, frustrating way, because you'd be basically the end result is you're bouncing around websites and the game constantly being told things that contradict each other, right? Where you like try to log in at one place and they're like, oh, you don't have an account. And then you go to the other place and they're like, and then you're like, oh, I guess I'll go re-register then.
Guess that feedback report you got was very calm and collected.
It actually was not. It was clearly the person was not happy, but I was very impressed and relieved that it was still a pretty calm. Because I've had some nasty ones in there.
Oh, yeah.
People are typically nasty about weirdly mundane stuff, though. Yeah, and then if you get somebody who's like actually had something like truly frustrating happen to them, oftentimes they keep it together pretty well. I don't know why is.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, the last truly nasty one I had was also somebody who like had a complicated, confusing issue, you know. Mm. So I got this ticket, and I was like, oh fuck! Like, I didn't reply to this guy who's been trapped in this, you know, hours long maze, and I didn't know what was going on, and I finally like. Then I had to go dig into it. So I was doing that last night and discovered that it's a bug basically between the legacy system and the new one. Details don't matter. But it's impacted 1,000 accounts. There's 1,000 people. 1,000. Who dealt with this, right?
So this is a long way of saying that you should hook up those notifications to Favreau so we can actually see.
Yeah, exactly.
Things.
Yeah. So it's this kind of stuff now where I'm like, okay, we got to merge all this shit in.
Pull it all together.
So that's just all in one place. And just things, wherever they are, just appears in our stupid inbox. And we deal with it in Favreau.
Yep. Yep. Like you said, simplify the intake, right?
All the intake.
So it all comes in one place and then you figure out what to do from there.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll have more to either like praise next week or whine about next week as we use Favreau
as we start using it more. Yep.
As we do.
So let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Fraser, who says, way back in episode 73, Mancy Patch Kids. That's the name of the episode.
Nice.
You talked about eventually expanding beyond games, becoming an indie publisher, selling tools to other devs, all sorts of stuff. What's happened to this goal in the intervening years?
Ooh. So I think actually kind of related to the stuff we've talked about just previously, which is the bandwidth problem and the increased realization of just how hard it really is to succeed at doing
one thing.
One thing.
Just one.
Let alone being like, oh, yeah, let's go spin up a tools division, which we've explored at various points and each time been like, wait a second, that would be starting a whole nother version of what we've done
whole new
in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I guess the short answer is basically that, which is the sort of it's basically, I think, as we've actually grown the studio and you know, grown products within it, grown our experience in this particular industry, recognizing just how much work and how long it takes to do that makes it so that you're not as trigger happy about starting a new thing in a completely sort of like even if it's kind of adjacent, the reality is like if you're selling tools now, you're doing something completely different if you're doing software as a service, right?
Yeah, I think you see that kind of a thing a lot more in the venture capital backed model of running companies, you know, because then like the founder will be there. They're already like wrangling money from all these different people and they have some product they're in the process of working on. They got these people who they brought in and slowly kind of accumulated like, you know, like these good people doing cool stuff. And then they have these ideas because they create tools while they're doing it that they're like, ooh, we could sell this. Or, you know, they do that kind of stuff. And there's a reason why that almost always now results in either nothing actually happening or that person going and seeking venture capital, right? Mm-hmm. And that's because like
– it's expensive as fuck.
It's expensive as fuck. And it's really risky, right? And because we have had these conversations really – I mean even actually just a few weeks ago. We were talking about like what's the future of Rumpus, you know, trying to figure out like what to think about this. What is it for? What does it do? And this all becomes actually more complicated because our industry is dominated by gatekeepers who get to do whatever they want, right?
Yes.
So if one of those –
make us do whatever they want.
And make us do whatever they want. Yeah. So if one of those gatekeepers at some point says, oh, we just aren't going to allow third-party logins on our system, right? Which has happened and actually just is true on some platforms, right, already. And there's some indicators on certain platforms that that's going to become more true, right? So now you take something like Rumpus where like – it's a cool thing that we've made, right? Where it's like, you just centralize your account. So wherever you go, whatever game you're playing, you can have these cross-game perks. You can be on one platform, move to another, have the same data.
One account to rule them all. Cross-platform freedom.
Woo. Yeah. But there's a reason that almost nobody else has that, right? Which is because
platforms hate it.
Platforms hate it. Yeah. And they've been actively working to make that impossible.
Because they want it's the walled garden is the term of art nowadays, but every platform wants to keep their players only in their ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a concept called switching costs, and they actually want it to be high.
People give Sony a lot of shit about their stance on crossplay, right? But like Sony has that stance because they are at the top right now.
Correct.
Right? Like they want to keep people in their platform because that's where most of the people are. If most of the people were on Xbox instead, Sony would be like, hey, we love crossplay. Why don't we get some of those Xbox people over here, right? So it's all just business stuff. But everybody wants to trap their users. And our approach is we say our customer is like an Xbox user and a PlayStation user and a Switch owner
and the platform and the platform
and it's
says,
the same person.
Yeah, but the platform the same says person. You don't have a customer. We have a customer.
Correct. Right?
And
that's our customer.
And that's buddy. And then sure, you person who made the game has to deal with all the support and has to do all that kind of stuff. Like you have to provide support for our customer, right? All of that stuff, right? So because of things like that, then there's this and you see this happen with startups and all kinds of industries where there's some giant out there, right, who always then is presented with a choice, which is buy or destroy, right? So some little upstart. Yes. And
Facebook buying Instagram, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the case of the game space, it changes so fast. And the rules are so arbitrary, and there's no legal protections basically for us or for basically the people making the games. So we just have to take whatever happens, and we have to work with that. So it's actually an incredibly risky business model to say not only we're going to try to make that work internally for our own games, but also we're going to try to find a way to invest even more resources into this, like turn this into a company itself, right? And a new product and find a way to sell it to other people. Because what happens when we sell this service, right? And then one day, one of those platforms says, oh, you can't use this service on our platform anymore, right?
Boom.
So now what do we do?
A quarter of your revenue just gone.
It's just
gone. Or even worse, you may have thousands of customers who are developers who have built their business on top of your business on top of that platform, right? Yeah. And so now you have this problem where you're trying to reconcile sort of like 1,000 angry developers whose livelihood is now impacted because your livelihood, like you're all screwed, right?
And of course, they're mad at you. You're mad at the platform.
Yeah. Everybody's mad, but you can't do anything about it.
But it just is what it is. So, all right, it's just kind of this interesting problem. It's a two-part. On the one hand, it's hard to know what the future looks like. But having said all of that, that's equally exactly as true for making games, right? The things I said about something like Rumpus, also true for games. No guarantee any given platform will give a shit about what we're doing at any given year.
It's just stuff like in-app purchases are a good example of that, right? Yeah. Because like there are game studios who have built their entire revenue model around loot boxes.
EA, for example. I think it's 37% of the revenue came from loot boxes last year.
Right. And like at any minute, the hammer could come down in certain countries where a significant portion of their revenue comes from, saying like, oh yeah, it turns out this is bad and it's illegal now, right?
Yeah. Or GDPR when it comes to – data privacy and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so like it's always the case that no matter who you are, unless you are the government, right, there are gatekeepers telling you what you can and can't do.
So to me, that's the
more
main thing
the deeper that stack goes of gatekeepers, the more risk you're building your business on top of a house of cards. Or a Jenga tower, I guess, would be a better example.
And I still having said all of that, I'm still less worried about that side of things than just the overwhelming cost of doing it. Because of course we made it the tool to serve exactly the needs that we have, right? And to work on the platforms that we're on, and we can change it on a whim so that if it turns out that one of these things that we talked about happens, we can find a way to accommodate and make it work still within our ecosystem, right? Because we're only juggling our own needs. But as soon as we're now going business to business, you know, and now all these other people depend on the thing that we're making, and now they have their own little set of completely unique things that they want to have happen, right? And if that's not provided, then now all of a sudden the tool starts to become something that limits them, right? Instead of gives them what they want. You see this is what happens basically with all services, right?
Yes.
Especially business to business services, is they just keep growing, right? And becoming more convoluted and complex until at some point everybody hates it. Everybody hates everything about it because there's too much there, right?
I wonder if this is why, because I know that anytime I need to use Skype now, I basically throw my computer out the window because I try to log in, I can't log in. And I reset my password, now I can log in. And then the next time I log in, the password I reset to doesn't work anymore for some reason. And it's probably because it's somehow like, – because I have lots of different Microsoft services that were all standalone services at one point with their own login system. But they consolidated the login somehow. I don't understand how.
I can tell you how, but without any detail, because it's
painfully NDA, and sort of
because it's
with duct tape.
Fucking wild. Because we didn't do this because we have Xbox sign in, right? So I won't go into details, but we obviously have that. So that's not an NDA thing, right? But the process by which we go from like you being like, oh, hey, I'm a Microsoft user, right? I'm on an Xbox playing this game and I want to be logged in, right? I want to be on the Rumpus service so I can now get the online content, right? The process by which you do that requires, I have to do a waterfall series where that first thing comes in from the Xbox. And it's like, hey, this is what I want to do. And then I have to now take that data, send it to one website, get some data back. Take that data, send it to another website, get that data back.
It's just like a huge pile.
I have to do it four times. I have to do that four times.
It's just a pile of logins.
Yeah, because you have to convert each kind of login into a different kind of login until finally you hit like the main Microsoft account. And then it can be like, okay, now I have like your user ID and email address, right?
Yeah, like because it's just like mergers and acquisitions and internal product teams that all get sort of brought in. And so, you know, thinking about stuff like that, it's like maybe that's why Zoom took off,
right? Because it does one thing.
Because like you're saying, as a business keeps adding stuff onto the stack without, like we were talking about earlier, without revisiting the context and reconsolidating things, with that like aggressive growth model, we just keep piling things on. It does get more and more convoluted and harder to understand and harder to manage for everybody involved, both internally and for your customers and everything else. Yeah. So
it is still the case, though, that if we do find ourselves at some point with an infinite runway and we end up kind of backing out of web tech and our games because of how hard it is to have that work on in the really cross-platform model that we currently follow, I still love the idea of actually truly spinning off like Rumpus as a service, you know, to sell to people. I don't know what that would look like exactly, but I still love the idea of doing that, because that would also be me getting to actually build a full product, you know, like with like a web product that could do this kind of stuff. And it's fun to have the idea of enabling developers to do cool stuff that currently is really fucking hard. It is so hard to do any little piece of the puzzle that Rumpus does. It's just that I've now had years to put it all together based on.
But again, I want to point out, technically, no. Politically, yes, right? Like,
I don't know what the no's and yeses mean in this.
I'm saying, like, if it's hard, right? Like, the the technology is not overly complicated in terms of, like.
Oh, it is, though. Like, talking to all these different services and, like, trying to figure out how everything works, and, like, it's a lot.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, it doesn't have to be that way. It just is that way. Like, what Rumpus does internally is like very cool, but also pretty straightforward, right? In terms of like the services that we have and like syncing files and stuff like that. So much of the complexity of the design of the thing has been just trying to figure out how to get it to talk to all these external things that are just like wacky stacks of just nonsense.
Consolidating like seven other platforms, you know, methods of talking amongst them, like within themselves, with the tool that then talks amongst all of them, is insane.
And it does make sense to say, like, you guys should sell that. Like, you're solving a big problem. It's like, yeah, but I mean, wow.
The reality has been, I'll just say this, the reality has been in the business context that while it's been a fantastic thing for us, I think, as independent developers, meaning not actually doing business with other businesses, to have all of the cross-platform tools we have built for ourselves. The one sticking point in nearly every business-to-business interaction we've had has been about the fact of cross-platform, whether or not it's allowed, to what degree it's allowed, whether or not people can move their saves, whether or not people can move their player data, whether or not they can hook themselves up to the service, and whether or not things like achievements and stuff like that comes across.
And which login methods we could use.
So you're legit, if you're in a position to start like pitching your game to platforms, you are better off not having any cross-platform features whatsoever, because that's actually a boon in that conversation.
Yeah. Which is and the reason we did it was because it's good for us and it's good for our players. Right. That's why we developed
this system at a time when we weren't having those conversations with platforms, you know? And so it's, which is also why it's like, well, why don't you sell that? It's like, well, cause would we be selling a benefit to people or just another problem?
Cause everything is, but it is still helpful to us today to be able to use that as a single platform, you know?
It helps our development a ton, because we also use all these internal web services for our own work.
Yeah. And it has helped some of our business pitches too, right?
Yep.
It's just that it helps in one place and hurts in another. And so, you know,
it can be a neutral presence.
It can, it's just kind of whatever it is. But it is one of those things that makes you know, all these platforms, all these giants, like, yelling at each other and being like, you know, we're great for developers, you know, and then all these players, wrapping around one entity or another being like, oh, I love this platform. And like, and the reality of it is that they only give a shit about themselves. That's it. Yep. And they're all fighting each other.
Reasonably.
We're all fighting each other, and we're just the little peons below who, you know, if we're lucky, we catch table scraps, and if we're not, we get crushed. Like, that's what
I'll take
is.
I'll take those table scraps. You know, the table scraps from like a multi-billion-dollar company, those are some good scraps.
It's like being an ant in a picnic. You know, you're like, fuck yeah, I got a whole peanut butter jelly sandwich.
Someone drops a crumb and you're like, this will feed my family for 63 years.
Yeah. But those very table scraps can also crush you if they land on you. So,
that's
you
know, true.
Yeah, you gotta be careful.
Gotta be agile.
All right. Now, before we sign off, I want to really quickly answer one question that's just for me and doesn't really warrant any conversation, but I just have to answer it.
Do it.
Which is a question from Fly Hoppy Axe Rampa, who says, Seth, what is your class and spec in WoW? The community is dying to know what the worst class in WoW is.
Nice.
Which I had mentioned a while back that I was one of the top monks, because monks were so bad that if I did reasonably okay, then I would be in like the top couple hundred in the world. I was a Mistweaver monk, worst healer. Nobody wants to bring them to anything. But that's, you know, that's the strength of it, right? Like, if you do well on something that sucks, people are like, damn, I didn't know that was possible. He's so good.
But then do they still out-heal you by like double without trying because it's, you know, balance?
I usually out heal them, but that's all that I do, right? So like all the other healers, they can do the healing, but then they also have tons of other stuff in their utility kit that they bring to the table, you know? Like they could be like, I just put down a big dome that if everybody gets inside of it, they take half damage for the next 20 seconds. Like I can't do that shit, right? So like I have to do tons of healing.
You got nothing else. You got one trick.
To sort of to justify my existence. Yep. My damage is not great either. So if like, if there's a time where no healing is needed and I get in there and start punching, it's like I'm slapping them with wet noodles, you know, but
it's good. You know what?
I'm getting in there and just doing it.
Yeah. If you can only do one thing, you're going to need to be basically the best at it.
You gotta be real good at it. Yep. So, you know, we got to double down, but yeah, if you want to check out my parses, go to Warcraft Logs. My character's name is Stoggz, Stoggz. I got some good ones in there.
Got some good ones.
They color code your ranking, right? So it's like, I think it's like, if it's like kind of like a whitish gold color, then you are the number one person in the world. Don't have any of those.
Bummer.
If it's pink, then that's a 99%, meaning like, you know, you did only 1% of the people in the world outperformed you. And then orange is the legendary parse. Like most of mine are orange and I've got a couple of pinks. So nice. I did pretty well for myself. I'm changing classes though this past year. I'm tired of playing a piece of crap. So, all right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers Fat Bard and Jen Koster for putting the podcast together, and thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net. We've got links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives, and of course. You know, feel free to send a tweet over to Favreau, you know, let them know they can sponsor, just like throw us some cash for the big shout outs that, you know, we could do that. That'd be, you know, we'd appreciate them. Be good. We could do that. Yep. So thank you all for listening and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.